Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Everyone Into the Pool refresher on the requirements for swimming pool lifts. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will have a question and answer session on the phone lines with instructions following at that time. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Peter Berg. Mr. Berg, you may begin your conference.
All right. Thank you very much, Tammy, and welcome to everyone wherever you may be located today on this fine February the 19th of 2013. The ADA Audio Conference is a project of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is comprised of 10 regional ADA centers. The network is funded by the U.S. Department of Education National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research. The ADA National Network is your source for accurate and timely information regarding the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Today we have participants joining us via phone and also through our webinar platform. For those of you in the webinar platform, you can control the audio by using the audio panel. The slider button can be used to control the sound volume, either sliding that left or right. If you're having any sound quality difficulties, you can run the audio setup wizard to make sure that your speakers are properly configured and so that you're able to hear the important information that is going to be delivered today. For those of you that require the use of captioning to access today's session, you can double-click on the captioning icon, and captioning can be that can be sized to meet your specific needs. For submitting questions, when we get to that point in time, for those of you that are joining us via telephone, when we get to the question and answer time, Tammy will come back and give instructions on how you can ask questions. For those of you in the webinar room, you simply need to double-click on Great Lakes in the participant list, and a box will open and you'll be able to submit your question. Your question will not be viewable to other participants, but the question will be seen by the moderators and today's speaker. For those of you that are using keyboard navigation in the webinar platform, you can use the F6 key and keep cycling around until you get to the participant list. Once in the participant list, use the up and down arrows to find Great Lakes, and right-click on Great Lakes, and you'll be able to submit your question that way. You can customize your view of the of the webinar platform, the whiteboard where the presentation is being displayed. You can adjust the size of that. You can see that to the top and left of the whiteboard, and that will allow you to adjust that to the specific size that you want. The three panels can also be adjusted, the participant list, the chat area, and that can be adjusted by clicking on the icon inside of the panel. So you can move those, you can make them larger, you can detach them. All right, if you encounter any difficulties during today's sessions, again, if you're in the webinar platform, you can You can't submit your question or submit your inquiry through the chat area. Again, selecting Great Lakes as the participant that you're going to send your message to. Or you can send an email to us at adaconferences@adagreatlakes.org, or you can phone us at 877-232-1990. All right. Now that we've gotten through with all of the housekeeping, get to the important stuff, and glad to be able to introduce to you Troy Balthazar, who is an ADA specialist with the Great Plains ADA Center, which is located at the University of Missouri. Pools have been a hot topic going back over 18 months. And Troy's going to update us and provide a presentation and allow for participants to pick his brain and ask his questions. So that's enough from me. Troy, I'll turn it over to you at this time. Welcome, Troy.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you all today. It certainly has been a hot topic lately with not only the changes in the standards and regulations, but having them put off a little while. Anyway, we'll try to summarize a little bit about not only what the date is. Obviously, we're past the date of January 31st, 2013, that the regulations go into effect. We're going to talk today, do a review of what the standards are. So identify what needs to be accessible under new construction standards and also talk about how to do that. So we'll cover the pool and spa scoping standards. We'll talk about Title II and basically about program accessibility, and Title III and readily achievable barrier removal. What we'll try to do here is answer the big questions that we're getting, such as, do I need a lift? How many lifts do I need? How many entrances do I need? There's distinct differences in what will come, the answer to those questions, based on if you're talking about a Title II entity with a requirement of program accessibility versus a Title III entity, which has a requirement for readily achievable barrier removal. Again, up front, we're looking at the same standards. So we're talking new construction standard. I think the real questions come in as to when existing facilities, existing programs, are in need of adding means of access to pools. We'll go over the scoping and the building requirements briefly. Then we'll talk about Title II and how pool lifts and all these issues relate to state operations of state and local governments. At that point, we'll have a question period before we get into Title III and how public accommodations, businesses, commercial properties are covered. We have entities covered by Title II and Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act. As we know, that covers most businesses, most operations of state and local government. The only types of facilities that aren't going to be complying are places in general that don't, you know, the ADAC doesn't tend to apply to, which is private clubs, churches, and a good chunk of the residential properties that we see, including those common areas. Now, while the ADA will apply to any pools that would be considered open to the public, if pools and apartment complexes are that are privately funded are only open to guests and tenants and their guests, then they're not addressed by the ADA in most cases. just so you know, the scoping for which pools and which elements need to be accessible is located in Chapter 2 of the Americans with Disabilities Act Accessibility Guidelines, and the design standards will be located in Chapter 10. As far as scoping goes on our pools, to start off talking about swimming pools, we got a couple pictures here, one of a guy using a pool lift and another of a gentleman using a sloped entry to get into the pool. Basically, you have a division between large pools and small pools. Okay, if you've got a pool that's 300 linear feet of pool wall or more, then you need two required accessible means of entrance into that pool. If you have less than 300 linear feet of pool wall, then only one entrance is required. Regardless of the size of the pool, the primary means of entry needs to be a pool lift or a sloped entry. So whether you need one entry or whether you need two, that first one is required to be that lift or a sloped entry. The secondary means of entry for pools that have more than 300 linear feet of pool wall are lifts, sloped entries, transfer walls, transfer stairs, pool stairs, and transfer systems, which we will get into shortly. Just to review again, the pools in general are divided between large and small. The ones 300 linear feet of pool wall and up are going to require those two means of entry. Under 300 linear feet of pool wall, one means of entry. Whatever size we've got, that first entry needs to be either a lift or a sloped entry. Going to move forward to looking at a sloped entry and talking a little bit about what constitutes that. Slide identifies that you need to get a sloped entry needs to go to a point that is 24 to 30 inches below the surface of the water at rest. Some of the other requirements for a sloped entry is that regardless of the slope, they are required to have handrails. Okay, and there's a minimum width of those handrails is 33 to 38 inches. Okay, so 33 to 38 inches space required between the handrails that serve as sloped entry. And the height is going to be like other handrails, 34 to 38. Sloped entries are required to comply with accessible routes except for slip resistance. So your surface conditions aren't called into question on sloped entries into pools or on the landings. However, the other requirements for accessible routes do apply. If you've got a ramp or a sloped entry that is greater than the slope of 1 to 20, then you will require landings at the top and bottom of that sloped entry, 36 inches wide minimum by 60 inches long or deep. Handrails, again, are required regardless of the slope. They require handrail extensions, as noted in the ADAG, at the top of the slope entry, but not at the bottom. The handrails should meet the other requirements for the ADAG as well as far as width, spacing, and secure attachment. Second, we've got pool lifts. And there's certain fair amount of requirements for pool lifts. I'll try to summarize them. Basically, pool lifts are required where the water does not exceed 48 inches. So if we have pools of varying depths, we want to make sure that we've got those pool lifts positioned so the water depth doesn't exceed 48 inches where we're going down. Footrests are required, and they must be provided and moved with the seat. Armrests are not provided, but if they are not required, but if they are provided, they need to be removable or fold in to, in a raised or load position. In other words, they've got to be movable easily and independently so a person can move them out of the way depending on their transfer needs. All pool lifts require feet that are 16 inches wide. It catches some people off guard, but there's no back required on a pool lift seat. However, obviously, it's a very good idea for stability. It's very going to be much more usable by a wider range of people, but the ADAG does not call for a back to that seat. The seat position, first of all, there needs to be a clear floor space adjacent to an accessible, connected to an accessible route that's going to serve that pool lift. The chair itself, the pool seat, in its up position, okay, in its at the deck position, is required to be between 16 and 19 inches above the pool deck. Pools should be capable of unassisted operation from both the deck position and from the submerged position. We get quite a few questions on whether covers for pool lifts and different types of security for pool lifts are going to be compliant. They're not compliant unless that pool lift is capable of unassisted operation. Okay, at both the deck level and the water. You've got to be able to call that thing. Lifting capacity, 300 pounds, absolute minimum. Again, there needs to be an accessible route connected to a clear floor space. We need to be thinking about operable controls, so when it's independently operable, we mean not only can we get to it, but the controls meet the requirements of the ADAG as well for operable parts. No twisting, pinching, grasping required, or not extreme anyway. And 5 pounds maximum force to operate those operable controls. So we're going to talk a little bit about the other, about three other means of access into the water. We've got pictures here of, in the upper left-hand corner, a transfer system. In the upper right-hand corner of the slide, your upper right-hand corner, we have a transfer wall. And then below that is an example of pool stairs that would be accessible. Again, this would be these types of entries, as far as pools go, swimming pools go, could be your secondary means of entry. If you have a pool that's greater than 300 feet of linear wall, and you need those two entries, that first one has to be, again, that sloped entry or the lift. The second one may be any of these three options, the transfer system, the pool wall, transfer wall, or the pool stairs. We'll start off just talking about transfer walls, first of all. These are pretty common at hot tubs, spas, things like that, and we're going to cover spas specifically here shortly. The transfer walls need at least one grab bar. These are the type of walls you can roll up to at deck height, okay, and you're going to have these walls be a 16 to 19 inch wall that's 12 to 16 inches deep, okay, that a person's able to roll up to or otherwise approach, sit on the pool wall and transfer themselves in at water level. So again, you see these a lot of times with above deck hot tubs. So the transfer walls have to have either one or two grab bars. They need at least one. All the grab bars need to be perpendicular to that pool wall and extend the depth, that 12 to 16 inch wide depth of the pool wall. Okay, so basically you've got either one or two grab bars with a gripping surface 4 to 6 inches above the wall that a person can use to support themselves as they transfer. If you got one bar provided, you need 24 inches on each side of the bar clear for a person to use. If you got two bars provided, the clearance has to be a minimum of 24 inches between those bars. And again, the grab bars, again, need to comply with other aspects of the ADAG as well. Now, we talked about the clear floor space needed at a lift, and it being 3648. Clear floor space required at transfer walls is actually going to be bigger at 60 by 60. Okay, so you need that connected to that transfer wall. I believe we mentioned it needs to be 16 to 19 inches high. The wall has to be a minimum of 60 inches long and be centered on that clear deck space. Okay, so the wall itself needs to be 60 inches long, and that needs to be centered on that 60 by 60 clear deck space that's required to use it. Another key consideration with pool walls and will become for transfer platforms and such is the surfacing. Obviously, a lot of skin exposed when we're transferring onto these things, prevent injuries. The wall surfaces have to have rounded edges, no sharp abrasive elements, so avoiding injury there. The second type we're going to talk about is a transfer system. Basically, what a transfer system is a transfer platform, okay, combined with a series of transfer steps that go down into the water and provide accessibility. So you've got two components of it. First is that transfer platform. Transfer platforms themselves, we need to be able to transfer onto those. We need a 19-inch depth, 24-inch width minimum to that. The height, just like the transfer wall, should be 16 to 19 inches measured from the deck, so we can transfer onto that platform. Now, adjacent to that platform, again, we need that 60 by 60 clear deck space. Okay, it's not just the wheelchair space, clear floor space needed. It's the 60 by 60 inches minimum. That space should be centered along the 24-inch minimum unobstructed side of the transfer platform, meaning that as you're approaching it and transferring onto it, at that 24-inch width, that 24-inch width be centered on that clear floor space, clear deck space. Connecting to the transfer platform will be transfer steps, okay? Transfer steps should be uniform as far as height goes, uniform risers. Maximum height of transfer steps are 8 inches. Okay, shorter heights are recommended. The tread depth is required at 14 inches to 17 inches maximum. And the minimum tread width is 24 inches. So each step, the maximum height of that step down is going to be 8 inches. The tread depth that you're stepping on would be 14 to 17 inches maximum, and a minimum tread width is required of 24 inches. Steps are required to extend in the water to a minimum of 18 inches below the stationary water level. Again, with the transfer platforms, the transfer steps, we really need to think about the surfacing. Are there abrasive elements there? Need to make sure there's no sharp elements or anything that's going to potentially injure somebody making that transfer. Finally, we have requirements for accessible pool stairs as another means of getting in. The key with accessible pool stairs is to have uniform riser heights, uniform tread widths, okay, and have no open risers. Okay, so we're talking solidly built stairs. We're talking stairs that have the same step up each time, the same height, and we want the same depth of tread width. Okay, and the tread width needs to be at least 11 inches, and likely will be more. Pool stairs have to have handrails that comply with the sizing and spacing requirements of in the ADAG. The width between pool stair handrails is between 20 and 24 inches. So that's the required range there to have those pool stairs flanked by handrails that are 20 to 24 inches wide. They do require handrail extensions at the top landing stairs, but not at the bottom. And again, the top of the handrail surface, just like in other parts of the ADAG, needs to be 34 to 38 inches above the stair nosing. Okay, a few quick notes on special types of pools. Wading pools are specifically must have one sloped entry when newly constructed. Handrails aren't required on these, but the sloped entry needs to extend to the deepest part of that wading pool. So wading pools, children's pools, other things like that, really a lift doesn't even do it. Most of them aren't deep enough. They're required in new construction to have that sloped entry, not requiring handrails, though. When we come across water play components, we need to look at the play area guidelines that are listed in Chapter 10 to identify accessible routes on those, you know, to determine the accessibility of that play structure in general. So if water play components are a part of the pool, what's going on in the pool, then we need to look to the playground guidelines as well. With water play components, if the accessible routes are submerged, you don't need to meet the cross slope, the running slope, or the slip resistant requirements of accessible routes. We should be hitting other things, but if the routes are submerged, you need not meet those cross slopes, running slopes, and slip resistant requirements, the surface requirements. Accessibility is generally not required on water slides. It is required that we have an accessible route to the edge of the catch pool. Okay, so you need to be able to approach the edge of that catch pool. Should be on an accessible route. Again, that space, clear floor space needed for a wheelchair and attached to an accessible route. Okay, directly about spas. Each spa under the new standards requires one accessible means of entry. Okay, and that means of entry is required to either be a pool lift, a transfer wall, or a transfer system, which we just covered. So each spa, one accessible means of entry. Now, there is an exception for spas in a cluster. Okay, so spas that are grouped together, 5% of those spas, but no less than one, needs an accessible means of entry. What does in a cluster mean? I mean, adjacent to each other is pretty close. When they talk about a cluster of restrooms, they talk about being within sight of each other. My understanding is that when we look at spas in a cluster, if we have them the farther we have them separated from each other, the less likely they are to be in a cluster. To be able to really nail that down about what, you know, designates an exact cluster is, I don't know if I can do that, but I can tell you that, you know, if you do have spas in the same area, reasonably close to each other, you're probably going to be able to consider those a cluster. Again, the entry can be a pool lift, transfer wall, or a transfer system. So that's just a quick review of some of the regulations or some of the building, the standards of where these lifts, where these accesses are needed, what type of accesses, and what they may look like. I'm going to get into now what the Department of Justice expects of Title II entities. We'll talk about new construction, and then we'll talk about alterations and how to apply program accessibility. So for Title II entities, state and local governments, the Department of Justice expects a new construction standard that there be a fixed lift at each swimming pool and spa covered by the standards. They do not allow for sharing. So if you have a pool and a spa next to each other, by the new construction standards, Department of Justice ruled out sharing those lifts. It's not only a usability thing, it's also a means of egress issue. So no sharing in new construction. You can use portables only if they're in a fixed position and independently usable during operating hours. Okay, so portable lifts, I mean, may be an option, but the fixedness that DOJ expects must at least be there during operating hours. It can, you know, there may be reasons to put them away, whether it's security or whatever, but at the same time, it also creates a bit of a, I would say, an administrative concern of being able to have that in place at all times during operating hours. So that needs to be taken into account. But in the new construction, basically we want a fixed lift, no sharing of those lifts, and need one at each swimming pool and spa covered by the standards. Now, alterations will be a little bit different story. Title II entities are required to meet that new construction standard to the greatest degree feasible. Okay, so a fixed lift is going to be an alteration. A fixed lift is required at each pool and spa unless that Title II entity can demonstrate a financial hardship, technical infeasibility, or if they can show they have overall program accessibility, which we're going to get into here in a second. DOJ went on to clarify that fixed lifts, again, may include that portable or movable lift that otherwise complies with the standards and can be attached firmly and fixed to that pool deck. Again, it must be in fixed place and operational during all hours. It's open to the public. So when it comes down to, I mean, in new construction, I think it's pretty obvious. You do it by the new standards. We need a fixed lift. There's no sharing, and that's what the requirement is. In existing facilities, in existing programs, we're looking at whether or not the entity has provided program access. So program accessibility is going to be the key question of whether or not the answer to the question of does my community need a pool lift, how many, and where should we put them. All these things come down to just basic program accessibility considerations. So just to review and to dig into that definition a little bit, program accessibility. need to operate each service program or activity so when viewed in its entirety is readily accessible to and usable by individuals with disabilities. Doesn't say anything about meeting absolute new construction standards outside of new construction. But what it does say is that look at the program in its overall state, okay, and it's over in its entirety. So first of all, we'll have to identify where our swimming facilities are as a Title II entity. Say the city of Columbia, Missouri could identify 7 public pools across Columbia in different areas. Okay, and then that entity, Columbia, Missouri, would want to identify where they are compliant at this point with the program accessibility regulations, and as far as entry into their pools and access to their programs. So, in other words, you'd be looking at, as a public entity, looking at your overall swimming program. You need to be able to define that. We need to be able to know the extent of the services we offer at different locations, what's involved in our swimming program. So looking at it in its entirety, you think about, again, you don't necessarily need to have everyone be accessible when we're talking about removing barriers. When we're looking at whether we're providing program accessibility, okay, we want to look at things like geographic equity, okay, throughout, you know, are all parts of the city being served to the geographic area? What are the range of services at those different facilities? Okay, does it make more sense to start moving towards program access in a facility that has more activities going on than one that's more isolated and has fewer things going on? Can also take into account any information gathered through needs assessments or other ways of identifying who your, you know, the makeup of your community and what the needs might be there. But just to key on this, again, program accessibility, when we talk about existing programs, then we're going to have to look at everything in its entirety. Okay, we want to make sure that in its entirety, we are giving, these entities are giving opportunities for people to use their programs. They may not all be accessible immediately, but we need to look at how, they need to step back and take a look at how they're currently providing that. Okay, what are some reasons to not have program accessibility for a Title II entity? Well, first of all, let's just talk about the limitations on program access. Entities don't need to make each existing facility accessible to and usable by people with disabilities. Again, need to remove barriers as necessary to ensure that that those programs are open and accessible to people with disabilities. That may not mean removing all physical barriers at one time or all physical barriers under a certain framework of time. There should be a plan to do that. It should be certainly part of a self-evaluation and transition plan that's required in the ADA, Title II entities. So you need to look, and so entities will benefit from having that type of plan and having that kind of information about what their current barriers are. And they'll be able to make smart decisions about how to remove those barriers, where to remove those barriers, that it's not only economically sound, but also opens up opportunities to the greatest population possible. Another limitation, obviously, doesn't require taking action to destroy historical significance. Doesn't require taking any action result in undue financial and administrative burdens. So from a management or just a funding standpoint, that can be an argument. Also, program accessibility doesn't require taking action that would fundamentally alter the nature of the service program or activity. I don't think that really is here or there with this topic. When you come down to talking about, you know, the limitations on program accessibility, the burden of proof is going to be on that entity. And again, not to stress it too much, but that self-evaluation, being able to show that good faith effort, knowing what the barriers are, knowing what our current situation is, and being able to show that the steps that have been taken are not only, geared towards meeting the greatest amount of needs with the resources that are available, but again, that good faith effort coming in and showing that, hey, this is what we're trying to do. That's what's really required here. Just a couple notes on safety. Because the question has come up fairly often. Public entity can impose legitimate safety requirements necessary to safe operations, services, programs, or activities, as long as, again, they're based on actual risk and not based on speculation. One of the big questions that comes out is, what about kids playing on these things and the safety, the liability involved there? Department of Justice has been very clear that that this isn't a legitimate argument for Title II entities or Title III. They haven't seen any cases that point towards misuse of accessible equipment as creating injuries or other safety issues. Doesn't mean it's never happened. It just means there's no proof for it, and we can't necessarily say we're not going to provide a fixed lift. We're only going to have a portable lift because we don't, you know, want kids playing on it. We just want to bring it out when we can. It's just, I mean, it's an arguable point, but the Department of Justice has pretty much shut it down ahead of time. So, again, those. Public entity may impose legitimate safety requirements. Some other considerations that come up are the number of lifeguards that are on duty, making sure we have posted rules, other considerations that we generally take into account for the general population. Just wanted to make note of that. Department of Justice sort of got out ahead on that one and said, this isn't going to be a real argument for not having a fixed lift in place during operating hours. Just want to keep in mind that there are other methods, again, to achieve program accessibility other than new construction, other than removing all barriers. Again, acquisition and redesign of equipment, signing of aids, alternate accessible locations. I think, when we're talking about somebody calls in, they want to use a certain pool, it behooves a Title II entity, a state or local government, to be able to say, well, here's the barriers at that pool, and here's what's going on at this other pool. Maybe we can provide you a service there. You know, to be able to make these kind of decisions on the fly in structured ways, too. To achieve, to communicate the program accessibility and what's being done, that good faith effort towards doing that. And as it applies, public entity, of course, will make reasonable modifications to policies, practices, and procedures where they're necessary to avoid discrimination. Public entity, just as a reminder, is not required to provide personal devices to individuals with disabilities, such as wheelchairs. What you want to think about here is overall program accessibility again. Is our program accessible? Let's say we have a population of, 15 people during the week who come over and want to use our pool facility. okay, but maybe cannot do it because their chairs won't go in the water. We want to think about, you know, what the need is in the community. That's part of the issue of program access for Title II. Need to take that into account. I guess what I'm saying is that I would consider, the consideration out there that providing wheelchairs that maybe a person could transfer into if they don't want to take their chair into the water can be damaging to wheelchairs. Obviously, power chairs aren't going in. So it's just something to think about for Title II entities from a program access side. Technically, again, you don't need to do the personal devices, but I would look at it as a program access issue and making good faith effort to ensure and work, including as many as possible. I'm going to stop there and take a breather and find out if you have any questions on specifically on how this applies to Title II. We are going to talk about Title III and how it relates to businesses such as hotel lodging and other businesses that have swimming facilities. But I'll open it up for questions right now.
All right, thanks, Troy. In a moment here, I'm going to have Tammy come back on the line and give instructions for phone participants. Again, for those participating in the webinar platform, if you have a question regarding either the technical requirements or the application of these requirements to state and local governments, double-click Great Lakes in the participant list and submit your question there. That'll go to the moderators and to the presenter. And if you're using keyboard navigation, use the F6 key to get to the participant list, arrow up or down to get to the Great Lakes, and double-click on that and ask the question. And I'll have Tammy give instructions for phone participants on how to ask questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key and then the number 1 on your touch-tone telephone. You'll hear a tone indicating that you've been placed into the queue.
All right. Well, we're waiting for the questions to get queued up there, Troy. I'll give you a couple of that that have come in. Both of these, they're similar, so I'm going to give you both. The first is a particular scenario where a local park district has 5 existing pools, one of which is scheduled to be scheduled to be replaced in 8 years as part of a long range plan. And the question is, do all of the pools need to be accessible? The other question, similar, is do all park district pools need to be made accessible? Or if they make one of the pools accessible, can they leave the rest alone?
Okay, yes, let's address that. I think there's not a firm formula and not a firm answer that we can give on, we got 5 pools or, how many do we need accessible? What we're looking at, again, we need to step back and take a look at that program access. Let's take that first scenario where we've got 5 pools and one's going to be replaced in 8 years. Okay, so we're certainly looking at 8 years down the road having that brand new facility, meeting the requirements of the ADA. The question is, what's going on in the meantime, for those next 8 years? And I think, the guidance I have on it is that you got 5 pools. I would take a look at, again, what services you're providing. Okay, what are we providing at each pool? Is each, if it's simple and it's just, a pool at each one, simple enough. Are we providing swim lessons and other types of scuba lessons and things like that at one facility versus another? The bare minimum I think you've got to provide access for in a situation where you've got 5 pools is absolutely 1, just for starters, to be able to show the first step towards program access. If we don't have any, then you just can't really show it. all you can show is existing undue burden or whatever you might be able to try to argue there. But you're looking at a bare minimum of one. So that first step should be taken. I would put this in the framework of a self-evaluation, okay, and saying, what are our barriers at these pools? Okay, which ones are the heaviest used? Okay, which ones are the easiest to modify? You know, what are these characteristics that's going to make moving towards fixing this pool up, okay, better than pools number 4 and 5, okay? We're always working towards full accessibility, okay? So just saying one, that doesn't mean your program is accessible. What you can do is move towards greater program accessibility and show that good faith effort by just taking into account, you know, exactly what the given situation is, you know, where, how geographically spread you are, how, you know, accessible to the community are these locations. You take into account these different facets of it, and prioritize the way you're going to get people in your programs. You know, the eventual goal. All five of them have an accessible means to get in. The requirement is that you make a good faith effort to meet that program accessibility requirement, and I think you can get that. Some, depending on your resources, depending on your, you know, how old your facilities are, that could mean that one accessible pool is a long ways towards program accessibility and what you're going to be able to do. If you're swimming in the dough, you can argue that, you know, that the program accessibility requirement is going to be higher. Okay, so in the sense that, you know, program accessibility is what it is, but you're working with a current situation. You take a look at that. You evaluate what you can do to remove barriers and start by providing at least one and moving on towards that and making your program more inclusive.
Okay, great, Troy. Tammy, do you have any questions on the telephone?
Yes, we do. Our first question comes from the line of Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. My question is, I've not seen anything in the requirements for the surface of steps, especially since they're going to be out in the sun, anything that protects them from getting too hot or from sharp or sandpaper type edges.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think there's anything on, you know, how hot the surface may get, but. I think it's certainly a consideration I hadn't even thought of. And the surface itself, the sandpaper, I mean, there's a lot of situations where people have, in practice, you know, end up getting, you know, raspberries, those abrasions on their skin, especially, a lot of people with those, impairment in the lower body aren't going to be able to feel some of that. So they definitely take into account, you know, the abrasiveness, same things about surface. As far as, you know, like, you know, surface that, you know, mitigates that heating up, you know, I don't know if there's a specific, I don't think there's a specific standard for that, but I think you could make the argument certainly that, you know, not taking that into account is possibly lending itself to a surface that is, or could you know, injure somebody with a disability. So in other words, I think if you got, so a couple examples. I mean, you can choose to, you know, use white, you know, find out how, you know, if there's types of surfaces out there that don't heat up as much, okay, like we would for any other patron. And but at the that versus a steel mirror surface, which is going to be blazing hot in 10 minutes. So I may be talking a little bit too much there.
All right, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't something I was missing, because we have not found anything that specifies that you can't use aluminum in terms of a ramp or that sort of.
Yeah, the materials are not specified in the standards.
Not that I know of, but I think it is a legitimate concern, and I think it's arguable that safe surface would imply that kind of thing.
All right, Rick, thanks for the question. Tammy, do we have one more question on the telephone?
Oh, we have two more. The next question is from Gary Edler. Your line is open.
Hi, my name is Paul. For the past 21 years, my company has done nothing but deal with setting up transfer systems for non-ambulatory individuals in all settings. And we've done many, many, many pools that cater to the non-ambulatory population. ADA obviously doesn't concern themselves with transfers that occur between the wheelchair and the pool lift. So therefore, we have to modify any pool lift to make sure that particular lift can take someone from the wheelchair to the water and then back to the wheelchair again. So even a self-operated pool lift like you guys have required for ADA specifications is completely useless in that situation. And all of these pools that cater to that population and set up programs for the non-ambulatory population are now not in compliance with ADA. So, number one, why doesn't ADA go far enough to deal with the non-ambulatory population to eliminate the transfer between the wheelchair and the pool lift? And number two, since they've already invested thousands of dollars in a lift that is specifically designed to service their population and doesn't deal with an individual that is somewhat ambulatory, like ADA seems to concern themselves with, how do they now have to spend another many, many thousands of dollars to get a quote-unquote ADA-compliant pool lift, which will really do them no good at all?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think, first of all, you get the question of, you start getting to the point where, where does it stop as far as being able to, an accessible parking space, for example. Well,
No. ADA should first and foremost deal with the most involved individuals, and they don't seem to deal with that at all. There's no thought whatsoever to how a person gets in and out of a wheelchair, for example. ADA only concerns themselves with individuals that can somehow get in and out of that particular wheelchair. In most of Europe and Canada, the first step is getting a person in and out of a wheelchair. Just like when you're dealing with a pool that services the non-ambulatory population, the first step is how can you safely get a person from the wheelchair to the water and the water back to the wheelchair? Forget about the fact that there's all kinds of other things that occur in the locker room. So now are you going to make these pools, and I've dealt with many, many, many pools that we've designed pools for that accomplish their particular program's needs. Now are they going to be forced to buy, quote-unquote, ADA pool lift that's really just going to sit there and do them no good?
Okay. All right. Thank you for your question, Trey. You want to go ahead and address that?
Okay. Basically, I can't vouch for the Access Board, the Department of Justice, on why they haven't come up with a transfer system with a pool lift to go get somebody out of their chair, pick them up, and put them into that chair. I just don't know that answer. To me, it sounds like, and what I was getting to was, there's a lot of accessible features out there that we don't necessarily plan to pick people up out of their wheelchair, transfer them in some other way to make that feature usable. That said, I think it's a legitimate concern that, that the ADA, you certainly have the right to that opinion that they don't go far enough with people who are more physically challenged than other folks.
Right, and that's right, that the ADA standards are a minimum set of standards that does not preclude one from going, above and beyond what the ADA minimum standards are. Under the 2010 standards, you can also use equivalent facilitation.
That's what I want to get to, is to your point about, what these businesses or what these places may have to do who are, specifically serving certain populations. I mean, you do have the argument, first of all, of equivalent facilitation. It's a high bar to hit, saying something that is equivalent to what's in the ADA standard. But I think when you've got a situation where you've got people, you've got a business, you've got a program that is catering to somebody with more significant disabilities, it also goes to the fundamental nature of the program. And what you may find is that the majority or a significant number of those people involved in that swimming program, for example, need assistance with transfers. And that's why I point out that the ADA doesn't mandate necessarily that you provide personal assistance, but the fact is, if you're going to be running that type of program, I think it's, sort of fundamental to the nature of what you're doing to provide that assistance. Now, that I agree that there may be other ways to do it. I'm sure there are lots of different types of pool lifts that may facilitate what you're talking about. But I think when you talk, I don't think people have to go in and rip those lifts out or look at what the services they're providing, how they're providing it, and if the argument is that, this is the safest way to go, and this is our population, and this is how we're serving them, I think that's a pretty good argument.
All right, Trey, do you want to pick up with the presentation, and then we'll get to open up the questions again when you're finished with that?
Okay, we're just going to finish up by talking about Title III entities, and here we're talking about, the lodging industry, the various industries that are going to, the health workout places, things like that. So all these places that are impacted by the Department of Justice's decision and regulations here. Title III entities, the same thing is expected as the Title II entities in new construction. Okay, if we have new construction, DOJ has made it clear they want a fixed lift at each swimming pool and spa covered by the standards. Again, no sharing. It's the same thing as with Title II. Portables only if they're in a fixed position and independently operable during operating hours. Okay, so that's the new construction requirement. Now, in alterations, you're always required to meet the new construction standards to the greatest degree feasible. So that will be a fixed lift required at each pool and spa unless it's not readily achievable for that public accommodation to do. That's where it comes, that's the big question here, is what is readily achievable for each individual business, each individual public accommodation? When using portable lifts, fixed lift, again, can have that portable component, but it has to be in fixed place during all operating hours. So it's there and it's usable independently by individuals with disabilities. Readily achievable barrier removal is our real question here. Okay, we know that we're required for building a new pool in a gym facility that we need to build it with accessible means of entrance. Now, we've got some places, some lodging facilities. I spend a lot of time in Branson, and, you know, they've got anything from brand new Holiday Inns, real luxury, to mom-and-pop places that are built on the side of a hill, and they, didn't make 10 grand last year. Okay, so there's a lot of different types of businesses out there and a lot of different ways that they'll be affected by these regulations. Regardless of if you're Holiday Inn or you're that mom and pop store, public accommodations are required to remove barriers that are readily achievable to do. The actual language in the law, easily accomplishable and able to be carried out without much difficulty or expense. Well, that's nice, but what does that mean? We don't have a formula for what that is. They tell you to take into account several factors, okay? The nature and the cost of the action needed. Example would be, there's a lot of wading pools out there that were built, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, okay, that don't have sloped entries. That's the only compliant way of getting into a wading pool at this point. It's going to be pretty extensive for most of those providers to rip out a pool wall and create a sloped entry long enough to get into the deepest part of that pool. It's going to be a very difficult kind of action. It's probably going to be very expensive. Okay, so you take that into account when you're considering if it's readily achievable for you to remove that barrier. You need to take into account what financial resources you have. Okay. Right, and the sites involved, taking into account the number of people, the effect on the expenses and resources, legitimate safety requirements you may have, taking into account what resources are available for not only, potentially any parent corporation as well, which we'll get into. There it is. Applicable to the type of operation or operations of any parent corporation or entity, including the composition, structure, or functions of the workplace of the parent company. So it's not necessarily just the Holiday Inn guy there who has the franchise. They do look up and look at the resources that would be available to the company as a bigger company. So how do we decide whether or not we're going to remove barriers? Well, let's take a hotel situation here. When we look at approaching readily achievable barrier removal, it's not required that we do a self-evaluation, but it really is going to help. If you can identify what the barriers are existing in your hotel, you've got a number of different things going on at a hotel. But the primary thing going on there is lodging. Okay, so you try to identify what barriers there are to accessibility that you have, and you want to place something like a swimming pool lift into those priorities. Okay, where does that come in? Can people get into my rooms? Can people... Is there a unit with a king size bed and an accessible bathroom that somebody could get into? So thinking about our priorities, and that's what we're going to get into here with barrier removal. Department of Justice has identified four priorities. Okay, it said priority one for barrier removal. Access to a place of public accommodation, public sidewalks, parking, or transportation. That's number one. If you don't have that, if that's one of your barriers, that's one place that you're going to start removing barriers prior to doing a pool lift. Okay, you're going to take these things into account based on Department of Justice's priority, but also, your existing condition, depending on if you're a gym, your hotel, what it may be. So you want to be able to provide access to that accommodation, maybe an entrance ramp. You want people getting in the door. You want those accessible parking places. So those are the first thing the Department of Justice identifies as priority one. Priority two would be access to the areas of a place of a public accommodation where goods and services are made available to the public. Okay. You can argue that this is where your swimming pools will come in. Okay. You could also argue it's in priority four. It's hard, you know, there's no specific thing that says your pools are in this priority. However, you can certainly under priority two continue to consider goods and services as being that pool that's available to people. Okay, so that's priority two, though. They want you to, after getting people in, okay, to provide access to those areas where goods and services are made available to the public. Now, again, I'm looking at what a lodging facility, for example, or a gym is doing. Okay, in a lodging facility, at a hotel, you know, I think your goods and services are prioritized as well. Again, do you have sleeping rooms that are available to people? Can somebody get a bite to eat if you have a restaurant? Can somebody get to the pool? Can somebody get to these different areas where services are provided? Then can a person get into that pool? Taking into account, the plan for readily achievable barrier removal takes into account all those barriers and prioritizes the removal of them. Eventually, yes, we want to get to full compliance. But it doesn't necessarily, but again, it has to also be taken in context. Priority three will be access to the restroom facilities. Pretty straightforward. And then priority four, any other measures necessary to provide access to goods, services, and facilities. Okay. Again, I think we need to keep in mind what the fundamental nature is of the business. If it's a gym, you know, it's pretty much fundamental nature to provide that swimming pool. Okay, that's what they're providing. Okay. In the sense of some hotels, the fundamental nature is having a place to sleep. Okay, then we get to these other areas, these amenities, these, you know, extras. So I think you really have to be thoughtful about which, you know, where you put a lift in, you know, in providing access to a pool in the big picture of what your barriers are as a business. And I think your self-evaluation goes a long way towards doing that. So, for businesses that have provided a lift, you know, you really want to make sure that we're maintaining that lift. It's in working condition when the pool's open. You know, just understanding what it's going to take for upkeep, staff support or maintenance. Think about operational policies. We want this moving smoothly. I mean, if you're providing, you know, this, let's make sure it's in place and operable and people know how to use it. Really stress ongoing staff training, how to respond to questions from individuals with disabilities, whether you have access to your pool or not, being able to describe that in a customer service kind of way. And let's see, DOJ made a very clear statement on any fear that pools or spas may have to be closed. It says, I'm just going to read it. Closing a pool or spa will never be required if it is not readily achievable to comply with the requirements, regardless of the reason that it's not readily achievable. In other words, if you have a legitimate, good faith, solid, reasonable argument that it is not readily achievable to provide access, then you've got to, then it doesn't require that you close that pool or spa. You just have legitimate reason to not be providing access because it's too expensive, it's too involved, whatever. Some of the, you know, the principles of reasonable, of readily achievable barrier removal we've talked about. The same basic concept applies to Title II. Of course, again, state and local governments with program accessibility. But DOJ, you know, makes it pretty clear that we're not talking about closing public pools just because we can't afford a lift. Any questions? I'll leave it open. That's just sort of a summary of readily achievable barrier removal, some of the things we want to take into account. If you're able, I think the key for business owners, for public accommodations, is to be aware of what the barriers are, be aware of what it would take to come up to compliance, and have a good faith reason strategy for removing barriers that one isn't going to break the business, but also shows a good faith effort towards meeting these barrier removal requirements. Readily achievable barrier removal is a very vague concept in a lot of ways. There is no formula. It's difficult for a lot of business owners to deal with that. I can't say I blame them. I mean, I think if I was being held to a certain standard to provide access under a civil rights law, and it had to do with my resources, I'd like a formula, but we don't have one. And so that's what we're stuck with, is to identify, again, what your barriers are, what's a reasonable way to get rid of them, and how to address that. Where does the pool lift fit into that?
Right, and Trey, do you just want to quickly mention the figures that you provided at the end of your presentation?
Yes, these are just in case we needed them, but just so you guys have them as well. It's just a list of the figures that are compiled in the Americans with Disabilities Act accessibility guidelines that show dimensions for things like transfer platforms, transfer stairs, clear floor spaces, all that. So in other words, just try to consolidate the figures so you have them in one spot, instead of necessarily have to flip back too much. But that's why those slides are provided. We would have, and if questions come up where we need to go to those, we'll jump to those. But otherwise, they're just for your information.
Okay, great. For folks in the webinar room, if you have questions, Title II, Title III, go ahead and submit those in the chat area. I'm going to ask Tammy to give instructions for our phone participants again on how they can get in the queue to ask a question.
Certainly. To ask a question over the phone lines, please press star then the number 1 on your touchtone telephone. You'll hear a tone indicating that you've been placed into the queue. If your question's been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the Q&A, you may press the pound sign.
Okay. And Troy, let me get you a question that came in previously in the webinar room. And this one was, a person thought that the portable lifts were only allowed if purchased prior to March 15th. 2012.
Well, let's look at portable in two ways here. Okay, first of all, yeah, a lot of people went out and bought lifts. Okay, and again, that's one consideration, not to get too far off the path here, but that's one consideration when you're looking at program access and readily achievable barrier removal. Okay. If you can point to something that you've got, say the portable lift, and you may be able to say, you know, we're providing access for quite a few people. It doesn't meet the new construction standards. However, we got bigger fish to fry. And apply, those efforts towards other types of barrier removal. There's two ways to look at portable. I mean, there's portable in the sense that they roll around. You can move them from pool to pool, okay? And then there's portable, meaning they're fixed while in position, but they can be removed and put away, okay, in some storage facility, as long as they're there operable. The requirement is that a pool lift be fixed in position, during operating hours. That's the absolute minimum requirement for new construction. So you got to have a fixed, you got to have something that's going to be able to be affixed to that deck, whether or not it can be put in storage or not. A lot of these that just roll around and don't mount to the deck, technically they're not going to meet that standard. They're not going to meet the new construction standard. Unless they can be mounted and fixed to that deck, they're not allowed. However, again, you know, depending on if you're arguing for inaccessibility or readily achievable barrier removal and how accessible your program or your business is, you know, I think you got a pretty decent argument to say, hey, we bought this in 2011 to be ahead of the game, and it meets all the requirements here, except it's not affixed to the deck. Then I'd start, you know, I'm justifying here a little bit, but I think that's what, you know, when you don't have a formula, you have to, you know, have a reason for, you know, you have to be able to justify your actions in that good faith effort. So, I wouldn't say, so the last thing I would say is, you know, as long as they're fairly compliant, you know, I wouldn't pitch those in the river and buy new ones. I would be looking, there's got to be other, you know, other things to work on before that, I would think. That's just opinion based on a hypothetical situation.
And also, Troy, in the Department of Justice questions and answers, accessibility requirements for existing pools at hotels and other public accommodations, they do mention in one of the questions that the department will not pursue enforcement against operators of pools that purchased portable lifts that comply with the 2010 standards as they were purchased prior to March 15th, 2012, as long, like you mentioned, as long as the lift is in operation and available for use at all times that the pool is open to the public. And in the document they cite the confusion amongst some pool operators as to the requirement to have the pool lifts fixed to the platform. Brittany, let's go to, do we have a question on the telephone?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Sheila Laurie, your line is open.
All right, go ahead with your question, Sheila.
No, our question has been answered since the last time we were able to ask questions.
All right, that's how good Troy is. He answers the question before he knows what they are. Can anybody have another question?
Thank you once again. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
All right. Let me go to questions that have come in the chat room. How does a hotel confirm that they have a spa that where it's not going to be readily achievable to provide that accessible means of entry and exit out of that pool? Is there some type of application or form that has to be submitted to the Department of Justice?
No, there's no form. Again, this is something that you just have to make the decision as a business we know what the law is, and there's no application requirement, for example. Okay, so again, you take into account, you know, what your existing condition is. There's a lot of it's pretty tough to put in a transfer wall for a spa that is, you know, at deck level. I mean, there's various, you know, reasons why, spas in particular can be very difficult to provide access to unless you have a lift. I'm not sure if I really answered that question very well, though.
Yeah, no, I think you talked about it, Troy, when you talk about that, you know, one of the DOJ regulations don't require places of public accommodation to do those self-evaluations. Those are the types of things that the operators of pools are going to need to do, in case they're challenged on whether they did engage in barrier removal and whether or not it is readily achievable that they go through the process and bring in, whomever to give them, cost expectations and as to whether or not a particular element, the pool, a spa, whatever it may be, can be made accessible. All right, let's go to, we've got a few questions coming in the webinar room. And this is another one along the signs along the lines of safety. What if a hotel primarily caters to youth groups and they're concerned about horseplay on the lift? What is suggested in the absence of a lifeguard or other type of monitoring device?
And the concern isn't, and I understand the concern isn't disability-related one at all. It's more of a teenager and youngster concern. I just want to stress, the Department of Justice has already said we don't have any reason to think that that's an issue. Okay, whether or not that's, I understand that there may be some opinions on that opinion or that finding, but that's what they've said, is it's not an argument not to have these accessible features, these lifts. Well, like any other, I would take into account how you're, ensuring safety in other ways. If we're not providing lifeguards, do we have posted rules? What are the posted rules? Do we hold people to those posted rules? Are we holding a youth group, or we let kids go out completely unsupervised and do what they want? It depends on the nature of what's going on there. It's going to be real hard for us to come up with a scenario where the Department of Justice hasn't already said it's not real arguable. I think it has a lot to do with the established safety rules, the established expectations. One of the Department of Justice always points out that there's other things that people can horse around on besides the lift, and I understand that this adds another element to it, but that's basically the way it's addressed. You address it with your safety, your programming, and however else you're keeping those kids safe.
All right, excellent. Let's get another one from the webinar room, and then we'll check with Tammy. Question about whether or not the pool requirements apply to community pools. So I'm guessing that they mean state or local government pool. If the pool is used for team swim meets, so some type of competition pool, or a pool where you have teams competing against each other.
Well, if that were the only use, okay, if that pool is never used except for competition, you'd still need it.
All right.
That's just a simple answer on
that. Straightforward. Tammy, do we have any...
If it would otherwise not qualify as a place of public accommodation... Okay, if it was in one of those exempt areas, such as the church, yeah. But like the University of Missouri, we got a competition tool, but it certainly falls under the requirements because there are competitors who may need it, and also most places are going to open up to other types of activities.
Excellent. All right, Tammy, any questions on the telephone at this time?
There are no questions in the queue.
All right. Try another question submitted I guess this is a public accommodation. Does the pool have to be kept poolside when the pool is closed? So you think of some of the climates and you have outdoor pools, you know, do those have to be, you know, remain in place at times when the pool itself is not open?
Yeah, just again during operating hours. So if your pool's open to the public from 10 to 6 through the summer months, then that's when that pool lift needs to be in there. Again, the key is that it be, not necessarily that it can't be taken from the deck, okay, but that it can be fixed to that deck during operating hours.
Okay. Excellent. Here's another question from the webinar room. For community-only pools, all other ADA requirements apply, such as for locker rooms, bathrooms, and shower rooms?
Absolutely. Pretty much anything that's part of that program or is supported by state or local government is going to be covered. Certainly, if we're looking at new construction of pool facility, you should be looking at everything, including locker rooms, showers, any changing rooms, any types of facility any part of that, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, we do have one more question on the phone lines now. We have a question from the line of Teresa Belusia. Your line is set.
Okay, here's our question. We didn't know for sure. Is there a compliance date for pools that are not new construction and ones that have not had any alterations done?
Yes. If we're talking about Title II or Title III, it's an ongoing responsibility to ensure, one, program access, or two, to engage in readily achievable barrier removal. So, technically it's been a requirement since the advent of the ADA with this specific standard, we now have something to point to, which is saying this is what it should look like. But there's not a drop-dead point where I can say you are absolutely out of compliance with program accessibility because you don't have lifts at all your swimming facilities as of January 31st, 2013. The regulation is enacted, okay? And as it always has been, we have either the responsibility to show that our programs are accessible or that we've engaged in readily achievable barrier removal. So we need to be able to point to that. That responsibility was there before January 31st. Now we just have specific standards to point to and say that's what it should look like in new construction.
All right, great. I've got another one submitted online. Just going back to the portable lifts question, person indicated that they had asked their question incorrectly. The questioner wants to know, can covered entities purchase non-fixed flashed portable lifts going forward?
For new construction?
For new construction or for to meet program access or barrier removal?
New construction for Title II or Title III, the answer is no. You need that fit. You need something that's going to be fixed. Okay. Now, what you can argue is if you already have something, okay, you can argue that you're providing program accessibility by having that. You would be... The big thing about January 31st is it says in new construction, when you're building something, this is what it's going to look like. Okay, it gives us as existing entities, okay, whether we're public or businesses, it gives us the standard now to shoot for. We now know what it's supposed to look like. Okay, where in the past we didn't. So. I guess what I'm saying is, in new construction, no, it's not just not acceptable. In alterations, it's acceptable if you can show it's not readily achievable, not to do it. Or if you can show something like we talked about, such as equivalent facilitation, maybe we've got this certain type of lift because of the population we serve or whatever. In other words, it sounds like the question is, you know, we've got some portable lifts, and can we keep them without buying new ones? And I think you can make a pretty good argument for that as long as they were acquired before what DOJ said, and that was March 15th, 2012, and that they otherwise meet the safety and construction standards of the ADAG.
I think that some of the confusion that around this is, it's not really the issue of portable versus non-portable. The issue, you know, going forward is fixed versus non-fixed, because, you know, technically you could have a quote-unquote portable lift that meets the technical requirements of the 2010 standards, and if you affix that to the pool deck, that's going to comply with the 2010 standards. So it's not so much portable versus non-portable. It's fixed versus non-fixed.
Just color this a little bit too, in the sense that, you know, another requirement is, I mean, one of the basic requirements is in new construction is that lifts are not shared between pools or pool and spa. Whereas, you know, the portable ones, those are, you know, those you can run back and forth, but they don't meet that standard if they can't be fixed. But again, if you've got something like that in an existing condition, you know, I think you're clearly, again, out of compliance with the new construction standard. But again, what kind of, I mean, that's when you start making the case of, you know, we've got, you know, we are providing this access in one way or another. We've purchased this before there was rules on how to do it. And guess what? It works and for 90% of the situations. You know what? No, it's not fixed to the thing. We'll include that in our plan for barrier removal. I mean, again, it comes down to each specific situation. But I guess the long and short of it is the new construction standard is that lift be fixed during operating hours or at all times, okay? And then if you're an existing facility, you start looking at the access you're providing through your programs as a Title II entity or your performance in readily achievable barrier removal over the last 25 years.
Excellent. Another question from online, a questioner asks, if the pool has over 300 linear feet, and must provide two means of accessible entry. Do both have to be a lift?
No, you can use a lift, sloped entry, transfer platform, pool stairs, or transfer wall is that other one.
As a secondary, okay.
If you need a second one, if you got a big pool, that second one could be any of those.
Any of the five. Okay. Excellent.
We do have another question on the phone line from the line of Barry Whaley. Your line is open.
Thank you. Troy, I guess I'm still confused, or just for clarification, what do we mean by fixed? I mean, does it actually have to be bolted to the pool deck? Can it be a sleeve where the main components of the lift are fitted in? I just want to make sure that I'm advised.
I'm right there and say your sleeve would be fine. When we talk about fixed, I mean, what I mean there is not necessarily, it's either bolted in, okay, or it's got a base that you can attach it to securely. So you've got some mechanism by which it's anchored to the ground. Okay, so that sleeve may very well do it. Now, does that specifically answer your question, or do you have a follow-up there?
You could pull this line back up, Danny.
It does. I just wanted to make sure that by fixed, it certainly can be removed if necessary, like in the instance you had mentioned before of a competition pool where you may need to remove that lift if it's causing an obstruction in the racing lane.
That's how Mizzou operates, absolutely. They've got sleeves out there. They can put it in there if they need it.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Question, Troy, about for Title III, any tax benefits available to businesses for existing pools, barrier removal?
Absolutely. There's depending on the size of your business, there's tax credits and tax incentives. Tax credits and tax deductions. And if you contact your local regional center, we can provide you that. I'm sorry, the local ADA center, the ADA center in your region, we can provide that information to you. And I believe the IRS has a packet on it as well.
Yes. Yeah, you know, the Department of Justice has several technical assistance documents on pools, as well as the tax information that you can get from your regional ADA center, or the pool documents are available on the ADA.gov homepage if you're interested in taking a look at that. Where's the question about handrails there? The question is, if they want to put handrails on the sloped entry, what specifications must they follow?
For the handrails on a sloped entry, we're looking at, first of all, I think the width is the thing to keep into consideration here. It's sort of it's 33 to 38 inches between those handrails, okay? So sort of a funky little dimension compared to other parts of the egg. So the handrail width is going to be 33 to 38. The height is 34 to 38. And basically, you've got extensions at the top, okay, but not at the bottom. And then for spacing and size and all that, it's straight out of the ADAC. It's the same the handrail requirements that are in Chapter 5 of the ADAC. And that's for diameter, for spacing, and all that. So it's other than the handrail width, Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention on it, too, is you do need the handrails regardless of the slope. So even if you're under 1 to 20 on a sloped entry, the handrails are required. I just didn't want to forget that.
All right, let's get one last question for you, Troy. Lots of great information. This process hasn't come up early because we've heard a lot of these questions. If the pool is not public, such as in a neighborhood, and I'm guessing that this person is talking about a pool controlled, operated by a homeowners association. Does the ADA, the 2010 standards apply to the pool, and also do the standards apply to the restrooms and locker rooms in that community pool house?
The answer is generally no, because basically the ADA isn't going to apply if this is a residential-based type of facility, okay, that meaning, serving residences there, that are used only by those people who live there and their guests. Okay, so it's not really, it doesn't fall under the heading of a public accommodation that way. It doesn't fall under Title III that way. It's just not one of the categories. Now, as soon as that's opened up to public events, then it is a place of public accommodation, and all those things do come into account. But in general, you know, in those situations that you're describing, I would be quick to refer, to suggest you call Fair Housing First, because I think it's more of a housing issue, and get the best guidance you can from a fair housing standpoint. But from the ADA standpoint, the types of pools you're talking about, and that are only open to those, you know, people who live there and their guests, or just don't fall under the public accommodation heading.
All right. Great, Troy. Well, for folks that didn't get their questions answered or who have questions come up down the line, you can always reach your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232, or you can visit www.adata.org to get access to your regional ADA center's website. Troy, I want to thank you for a great presentation and dealing with a wide-ranging field of questions coming in. This is a topic that is still going to be a hot topic for time to come. So appreciate your time and effort in putting together the presentation and delivering it here today. Just as a reminder, today's session has been recorded, and the archive will be available in 7 business days and will be posted to the www.ada-audio.org website. I want to remind you that our next session is coming up on March the 19th, where we will, the topic of that session is Throwing the Switch, Empowering Advocates to Make the Most of Current Trends in Disability and Technology Policy. You can get information about that session and register for the session by visiting www.ada-audio.org. If you have any questions regarding the ADA audio conference series, you can contact the Great Lakes ADA Center by calling 877-232-1990. And again, if you have questions regarding the requirements of the ADA, you may reach your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232. Again, I want to thank Troy for joining us today, and most of all, I want to thank all of you for joining us and participating in today's audio conference session. At this time, the session is over. For those of you in the webinar room, you simply need to close your internet browser to exit the webinar room. Thank you, and good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference. You may all disconnect at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks, Troy.
Peter.